Hey everybody, welcome to the 50th episode of Bikescape, April 6th, 2008. Hey, maybe you're the type of person who puts your foot down at the stop sign every single time when you get to an intersection and waits until all the traffic's gone and then proceeds safely after looking both ways. Or maybe you're the kind of person who just blows through with your eyes closed. Or most likely you're somebody right in between the two extremes. But wherever you stand on this continuum, it's important to know where you stand in relation to the law. And that's why Bob Mianski wrote a book, Bicycling and the Law, Your Rights as a Cyclist. Now, Bob, if you read the Velo News, you probably read his column. It's a column on bicycle law called Legally Speaking. And he's also written this book recently, which he's been going on tour promoting. And he made a stop in San Francisco. Bob started out as a competitive cyclist. He was a two-time Olympic racing cyclist for the United States in 1988 and 1992. He came in fourth in the 88 Summer Olympics held in Seoul in the individual road race, and he retired from professional racing in 1993. And he's now an attorney based in Portland, Oregon, with a practice in bicycle law. So he writes this Legally Speaking column, and he's very popular because he writes a really nice column. It's informative and not dry, as you would expect it to be. And neither is his book. I recommend it highly, and it's a great book. So anyway, Bob was up at the Treehouse at 995 Market Street, the home of the San Francisco Bicycle Coalition, for a talk on his book and just about the bicycle law in general. And it turned into a nice freewheeling discussion with several people in the audience. There were about 30 people there. So we're going to go to that right now. And it goes on for about an hour. And for that reason, I'm going to dispense with the main topic discussion that I usually have with local news and whatnot. But I am at the moment working on another podcast where we are going to be interviewing Bob as soon as he gets his Skype together on his end in Portland. And I have an interview already in the can with Leah Shaham, who's the executive director of the Bike Coalition, to discuss some of the recent events that have happened in the San Francisco Bay Area. A couple of people were tragically killed by a police officer, actually, who seemed to have fallen asleep at the wheel and hit them and severely injured a third person. So we're going to talk about how the law handles that and their the interesting situation with a police officer, and also how the media handled it what the repercussions were in the media. Anyway, let's go to the Treehouse over on Market Street and listen to Andy Thornley as he introduces Bob Mianski.
Thank you all for coming out to the Treehouse tonight. I'm Andy Thornley. I get to work here at the Bike Coalition, and we're so glad this evening to have at the Bicycle Coalition Bob Mianski, Olympian cyclist, author, and lawyer, among other things. And I see people already holding on to his book, Bicycling and the Law, which was published only last year, about 6 months, 9 months ago. It's still pretty fresh. And we are selling it on our website, and you can also get it as a premium if you sign up in your membership. And we're trying to get a lot of copies out there, and we're trying to sell a lot of books so that Bob can afford to come around and play with us sometimes. Who's a member of the Bike Coalition already? Fantastic. Who is not yet a member of the Bike Coalition? All right, good. Well, we'll get you signed up. One of these guys already slipped me a little donation, and thank you very much. If you ride a bicycle in San Francisco, you should be a member of the San Francisco Bike Coalition. We are the bicyclist union. We are looking after your rights. We are looking after your pavement, your stripes. And when I go to City Hall and I stand up and I say, I'm Andy Thornley, and on behalf of the 8,700 members of the San Francisco Bicycle Coalition, I'll be speaking for you. And that's why you're a member. And there are other reasons, right, Bob? You get a discount at Chops. You get that two times every other week. But the real reason is the glow in your heart to know that you're part of
the podcast.
So you get a podcast. You get John Winston will come to your home and actually record your every thought. All those things are part of it. So thank you for being members, and those who are not yet, I look forward to having you join the organization. Let's go on to the program. Our guest tonight, and again, can't appreciate enough that Bob is with us. Bob will tell you some tales of his experiences on the circuit racing, and then the dock, cross-examining difficult witnesses. And everything in between.
Some of each.
Again, if you've not yet seen or had a chance to read or look at Bob's book, we've got copies here, and we can probably sell you one tonight, or you can buy it online. Once you read it, you're going to want to buy gift copies to give to all your friends. So it really is a great book. I had a chance to look at about the first third of it last year when it was in galleys. And it really is the book that I've been waiting for my daily practice here as the guy that picks up the phone when somebody has just been hit by a bread truck or somebody's bike has just gone missing or some other legal problem. And I've always said, geez, there should be a common sense reference book about bike law, and there really doesn't seem to be. And there should be a book that you can read at various points as a narrative. And it works very well on both of those fronts. And that's very successful as a story and also as a very specific point of reference. So enough from me. I now give you Bob Majewski, our guest for this evening. Thanks for being here, Bob.
All right, absolutely.
Carry on.
Well, thanks for that introduction. It's an honor to speak in front of a group that's so old, not you all, but the group, 1970, and it's so powerful. And so you've got great numbers, so it's I probably could learn a lot from you, and I mean that sincerely. I put my book together over the course of about 6 months, and I'm still learning and coming up with new things I want to put in the next edition. But anyhow, I am a lawyer, and the way we look at the way we analyze things is to go through case examples. And so I wanted to give you a couple cases that I've worked on, a couple that I've read about, a couple that I have in the book, a couple that I haven't. The first case is about a guy named Y.E. Smith, who was riding his bike in Topeka, Kansas. It was the first day of summer, and he had to get across the Kansas River, and there was only one bridge. And the only problem was there's an ordinance on that bridge that doesn't allow cycling. But he went for it. He made about halfway, and he was pulled over, and he was arrested and charged with violating their city ordinance. But he decided to challenge the law. He lost at trial. He lost at the Court of Appeals. And then he took it to the Supreme Court of Kansas. And the Supreme Court of Kansas, in their holding, has declared that a bicycle is a vehicle and that the city of Topeka was in the wrong. And so this is a great result for cycling. That's good for them.
When was this?
Well, you're ruining my story. It was 1890. So a couple of states over to the east in Illinois, more recent story and a not as happy ending story, there's a guy named John Boob, B-O-U-B, and he was crossing a one-lane bridge. It has planks. It has asphalt between the planks. But the city had it under construction, and the asphalt was removed, and he didn't know that. And he started to head across. His bike stopped. He didn't. He was injured, and he brought suit against the city of Wayne, Illinois, and because they failed to warn that they had it under construction, and they hadn't kept it in a reasonable condition for passage. So he brought that suit, and he lost at trial. He appealed it, and he lost at the Court of Appeals. So it went up to the Illinois Supreme Court, and the Illinois Supreme Court looked at all the facts and decided that while a cyclist is a permitted user of the roads, that in this case, since there was no signage on the road and there was nothing like a street sign that shows a bike or something painted, that they were not an intended user. And so this is the law in Illinois. Cyclists don't have the same rights as you do in California. What's happened now is and this is 1998, this case was decided. If you are injured, if you have some problems, if you're in a vehicle, you're okay, a motor vehicle. But if you're on a bicycle and you get injured, you no longer have any recourse at law. And this is pushing the wrong direction. And this is where the punchline comes in, you know, which one was 120 years ago and which one was 10 years ago. But so as you can see, the trend is going the wrong way. And this is why I'm doing what I'm doing. I want to kind of, you can talk to anybody that's into cycling and they'll know what you're talking about, but it's like we don't talk to each other. I mean, I know that's what this organization does, but you'd be surprised what the powers can do against cyclists.
Is that a fair illustration of overall trend?
Yeah, which comment? The one that...
Well, that example you just gave, you see the trend's going in the wrong direction.
I believe it is. I think there's more competition for the roadway, and... Yeah, absolutely.
Along that line, can you talk about Iowa?
I can jump right into it. And that's another... In Iowa, as he's referencing, RAGBRAI. People are familiar with RAGBRAI, Race Across or Ride Across Greater something Iowa. So it's a big ride. It's been happening forever, even before, like, the latest cycling boom. It's a big moneymaker for Iowa. What happened was... The county said that the roads were all safe, but they realized there was a crack, much like the boob case. There was a crack in the road, and they had people standing there all day long until the end of the ride, and then the police left. And somebody caught his wheel in there, and he fell, and he died. And he brought his estate brought suit against the county for failing to keep the road in repair. And so what's happened since then is that county is no longer letting the ride come through the borders of their county. And there's a county association in all of Iowa that's getting together and trying to pass a new law that's going to sort of have the same effect that we've just learned about with the boob case, where we're permitted to be out there, but we're not intended to be out there. And if we're not intended to be out there, we don't have rights. If we don't have rights, we don't have recourse. And this is marginalizing, you know, a form of vehicular traffic, one that doesn't pollute, one that doesn't crush people, one that keeps the environment green, doesn't add to congestion. And so there is a push in the wrong direction. As much as cycling is growing, the other, you know how the world works. People that have the gold, it's the golden rule. And so if you're going to push against the county, you're going to push against a big business, they're going to put their influence on the laws. And so the cycling groups have to get together and stop it. And in Portland, we've been able to do that. And as I was discussing before the talk, in Portland... Actually, it's a great segue because we have some tragic cases in Portland, and I think I need to explain what's happened and what we've done about it. The first case, a 19-year-old named Tracy Sparling, and I like to use their names because, you know, this is the last time people will hear their names aside from their family members. You know, 19 years old, and that's it. She's gone. She was an art student. She was on a fixed gear. She came. She was in the bike path. She came to a red light. There's a cement truck to her left. When the light turned green, she started out, and he turned in front of her and violated her right away and literally crushed her under his wheels. So what happened was the police came, they closed the scene, and they did their crash investigation or accident investigation. They determined that even though the cement truck driver had violated Tracy's right away, he didn't perceive that he was violating her right away, which there's nothing in the law that speaks about perceiving right of way. You know, it's an absolute. A week later, a guy named Brett Jarlemick, cyclocross racer. She was an art student at Pacific Northwest Art College, and so was Brett. And Brett was a cyclocross racer. He was overtaken by a garbage truck on a downhill. And when he got down to the bottom of the hill, the truck driver, some reports say he had a turning signal on, others say he didn't. He stopped. And this is sort of the classic bait and hook, where the bait is, okay, I'm stopping, you can come through. So he starts to go through, and then the garbage truck turned and did a right hook on him, knocked him down. Same result, under the wheels. I was there. I saw that. I didn't see the fall, but I was riding past, and I stopped. And, again, the police department closed the scene and determined that he had to be able to perceive that he was violating Brett's right of way, or he hadn't. So no tickets were issued in either case. And so, as you can imagine, the cycling community was up in arms. It turns out this guy had 25 moving violations. His rearview mirror was held together with duct tape and bungee cords. In spite of that, they didn't ticket him. So the response, so the media picked it up. Do you have a question?
Yeah, I just had a question. Is that related? It sounds like that's related to Oregon's very unique law that bicycles have to stay on the right-hand side. They don't weave over as it used to, for instance, a California law.
Changed that law. I think are you referencing the fact that if you come up in a queue of cars, you can't pass them on the right?
You can pass them, as I understand, in Oregon, you can pass them on the right, but vehicles have to yield to bicyclists going through, and in both of those cases, on a right hook, as you mentioned, it's the job of the operator to look and see there are no bicycles there. But there's a difference from California law, where bicycles are expected to move out and move around, and vehicles are expected to merge into the bike lane.
So in California, and actually they did a pretty nice job in our paper of talking about the California law in that case. But yeah, and some people, in other words, if you're in the bike path and someone's going to turn, they take the bike path. So you're apprised that they're going to take a right-hand turn. Whereas in Oregon, you have to remain in your lane until your right-hand turn, and that's what leads to these kinds of collisions.
Yeah, we have a dashed line in the weaving area for that crossing.
Yeah, absolutely. That probably would solve that problem. This all goes down to the vehicular cyclist. I don't know if you all know what that's all about. There's a kind of a two different schools about how we should behave when we're out on the road in our bicycles. The vehicular cyclists, this is John Forrester, you know, he's like, you know, a founding author and activist. He says, you act like a car. You just act like a car. You take the lane and they just have to deal with us. The other idea is to push off the infrastructure, make sequestered roads for us, you know, our own path, our own lane. And they feel that if we allow the government to do that, that's a slippery slope to losing our rights to the road. So they're very adamant. And I know, because if I write a column and I give some advice that doesn't go lockstep with them, my inbox gets filled with hate emails. But the more I look at what's happening, the more I see what he's saying might make sense. Because that's what's happening. You know, they're starting to say this street isn't safe for cyclists and the police will kick you off even though it's against the law. Which leads me sort of to the next point about the what's happened in Oregon. What happened was the media ran a bunch of stories, bicycles versus cars, and they ran footage of cyclists running stop signs. This is the response to two cyclists getting crushed who were riding legally. And so this really got everyone up in arms. And so the media really needs to learn what they're doing. We need to make sure we hold their feet to the fire. A week after this happened, I got a call from a mom, and she said her son had been knocked out on his bike. His bike was destroyed. He had a badly damaged shoulder, and he got two tickets. So, and they had no money. So I said, "All right." I'm going to hear how bad, you know, the guy's riding the wrong way, and I'm going to tell him, you know, don't do that. Maybe I'll help you get it reduced. But the more he talked to me, the more the story didn't make sense. And so it turns out he got knocked out, and he didn't know what had happened, and the driver that hit him was going into a diabetic coma, so he didn't know what happened. So the officer went up and said, "What kind of bike do you have?" And he knew, and he said, "What's your phone number?" And he knew, and he said, "What happened here?" And the guy couldn't tell him, so he wrote him two tickets based on the fact that, you know, he was non-responsive. And so we took it to trial, and I asked the officer if he had had emergency training, and he said he had. And then I asked him about short-term and long-term memory, because, of course, he knew what kind of bike he had, and he knew for weeks, and he knew what his phone number was because he'd had it for years. But the accident only happened 5 minutes ago, and that part of his hard drive was erased, and he had no memory. He didn't bother to go to the emergency room to find out and interview the guy. The driver couldn't tell him anything because he was being treated for low blood sugar, but he wrote the tickets. The newspaper and the TV stations, you know, this was a hot topic because of the two deaths, our fifth and sixth of the year in Portland. And so they wrote, they had a picture, wrong way cyclist, hits driver has heart attack. So that was what we had on our front page. So then I took it. I moved to dismiss, and the judge granted it. And then I called the TV station. I called the newspaper. They weren't interested. That was so last October. You know, they didn't want to talk about it. So this is what happens. You know, people don't go out in the street and see what's happening. They rely on the media to tell them. And if the media gets it wrong, the people get it wrong. And, you know, we're trying to win the hearts and minds of the public so we can be, you know, in a safer environment. And if the media is not doing it for us.
Could I suggest something along that line? I've recently taken up the habit of setting the Google News. You can have it filter to return bicycle accidents. You know, you can say search, you know, bicycle, and I read them all. And it's real easy to fire off letters to the editor and to the police chief where these accidents happen. It takes 10 minutes and it's kind of fun, frankly, to, you know, nationwide complain.
That's a great idea.
It actually works real easy. I do it when I'm bored at work.
I'm gonna check that out, and I'm gonna maybe suggest that to my readers. You know, I write for Velo News. I don't know if you all know that, but I write for a competitive cycling journal. But even though that's the case, they give me a lot of breath, and I talk about these issues. I've written about all the cases that I'm discussing tonight, because that leads me to another issue. The people that are active, they'll show up at meetings like this. They'll join organizations. They're the best. But the thing is, the club riders, the racer types, the single speed people, there are so many of them. And if we can get them sort of to put their shoulder in with us, we could have a lot more power. And so when I'm giving these talks, I'm giving like 50, some in front of groups of like 300 people, bike racer types. I intend to like get a little flame underneath them. You know, I was a racer, I was a coach, I was in that world, and I want to show them. See, when I was a racer, what I would do, if somebody harassed me, is I'd harass them back twice as bad. You know, that's, I was young, I was competitive.
That's what you locks are for.
What's that?
That's what you locks are for.
But the problem that I've kind of come up with, you know, determined after doing this for a while, is I'm not really making the environment better. I beat that guy. I bested him. But what's he going to do to the next cyclist he sees? You know, so I've changed my tact. In fact, I saw online, there's somebody selling these little magnetic 3x5 cards. Does anybody know about those?
Throw them on like a yellow card.
And I got to do some research to see if that's legal. But either way, I'm going to say do it. But I don't know. You got to have it at your ready, right? I guess if you have a metal bike, you can have them on the top tube. And then somebody messes with you, and you give them a lesson. You know, when they get home, they're like, "What's that?" And then it's a magnetic business card. And do you know what it says?
No, I don't. I think I've heard them described as yellow cards, which is sort of a tribute to international football, soccer. You know, when the referee gives you a yellow card for a penalty. Mm-hmm. And so you can give somebody a yellow card, and you can flail it and stick it to them, and I suppose it can say whatever you want. Please, sir, join our civilization. That's or something like that.
Yeah, there's some legal issues there. I just know it, but I don't care. That's going to be a great column. I've got two new column ideas already. This has been fruitful for me. Yours Excellent. About the Google News and doing this card idea and personalizing them. But this is the talk I'm going to give the bike racer club types, and there's a lot of them. You know, like the League of American Bicyclists claim to have 300 members. 300, what did they say, 100,000 membership? Or maybe 300,000?
I don't remember what it is right now, but it's in that range.
It's a huge number, but the fact is it's more like 20 or 30,000. And if you're in a club and you're affiliated, they're calling your members members. But they're not. And those are the people I want to talk to. And I will be talking to them. And
the
I need a way.
Bicycle Film Festival, too.
What's that?
Go to the Bicycle Film Festival.
I'm going to.
Yeah,
I mean, biking is just... I mean, if you've been biking a long time, it's kind of... It's good to see it growing, but it's kind of like, everybody's doing it, you know? It's kind of like, it was cool sport, and that was esoteric, and now... But I like it, you know? But the thing is, we need... I mean, some people say 50 million. I don't know. But 9, 10 million, I think that's pretty accurate. And that's a huge group of people. And the demographic from, you know, a messenger all the way up to CEOs. And
to George Bush?
Yeah, to George Bush. Harry, they ride bikes, too. So... Absolutely, and they're not coalesced under any umbrella.
Wasn't Portland named one of the bicycle-friendliest cities in the country?
And this is in response to the problem with the media that I highlighted? I mean, it's kind of like that's as good as it gets, you know? I mean, I didn't highlight all the good things that are happening up there, but part of the thing is I really feel like we need a civil rights movement. I really do.
Well, Bob, maybe I can segue you into the topic I'm really keen on, and that Oregon has firsthand experience, and California not so much, and this is traffic justice. We were talking before about, I'll tell you a story in San Francisco. A year ago, Market and Octavia, we have a freeway ramp, and it's illegal for motorists to make a turn onto the freeway ramp because it crosses a bike lane, and there are other places to get on the freeway. And we've had many cases of motorists making that turn and endangering cyclists and pedestrians. And one woman in particular, poor Margaret Timbrell, was riding to work, had a tradesman in a big oversized pickup truck that was all full of bags of sand, turned in front of her, cut her down, knocked her over, rode over her, broke 24 of her bones, collapsed her lung, almost killed her, and continued up the road. Eyewitnesses called the police. The police were summoned, gave pursuit, followed the truck, went down the highway, met him at the next exit, pulled him over, bang, bang, bang on the window. He said, "Yeah, what's up, officer?" They say, "Well, do you realize you ran over a woman on a bicycle back there?" He said, "Oh, no, I had no idea." And they said, "Oh, okay, well, then it's not hit and run. It's a $100 ticket for making an illegal turn." Now, a $100 ticket for almost killing this woman doesn't seem like justice. And if that guy had been swinging a shotgun and had gone off accidentally, or if he had a chainsaw and actually cut the woman in half, it wouldn't have been $100. But because it's a motor vehicle in the United States, could it happen to anyone? That might have been you. Might have been you reaching for a CD on the floor of your truck. And the jury says, "Oh, you know, it's a really awful story, but we, you know, we really have to let that guy go." The disconnect between the injury that can be caused by a careless operation of a motor vehicle and the justice that's delivered is a huge gap. And there's a lot of attention all over the country on this. Here in California, a couple of years ago, we passed state legislation that makes it something like a $50 extra fine if you injure somebody when you're operating a motor vehicle. And if you kill them, it's $120, something preposterous. Oregon last year passed into law a vulnerable road users law that defines a class of road users, bicyclists, skateboarders, scooter riders, had been motorcyclists, but the motorcyclists fell out of the legislation on the way to being passed, and says that if you, in operating a motor vehicle carelessly, maybe I should turn it over to you.
No, you know.
Basically,
you got it.
It establishes a class of roadway users that if you injure one of these people while you're operating a motor vehicle, the penalty is considerable, several hundred dollars.
And it's like $12,000.
Suspension of license as well, I believe, in some cases. You can buy your way out of it with driver's ed, and you can. There's some ways to mitigate it a little bit, but basically, it's an attempt to associate a much more fair kind of a penalty to carelessly pointing your gun in the wrong direction and just shooting it off. So Oregon has got this in place. It became effective January 1st, I think. So there's probably not a lot of case law yet, and I'm kind of curious whether some of these recent Portland cases are going to come up there. Last week, I was on a phone call with the California Bike Coalition Legislative Committee, and I repeated what I've asked for before, that is it time that California bring this kind of legislation forward? Does the state bike advocacy organization feel that this is worth fighting for? And they said, "Yeah, it is, but, you know, politically, we're going to have to offer something up from the bicyclist side." You know, because there's this perception that bicyclists are outlaws and bicyclists are careless people and they get away with murder. And I said, "Okay, well, if we push for a law that that puts a very significant fine on a motorist injuring or killing a bicyclist, then I'm happy if I injure or kill a motorist with my bike. I'll also come up with that." And they didn't laugh at the other end. They're thinking, no, we have to make penalties stricter for bicyclists running stop signs. We have to make penalties stricter for bicyclists being naughty. And I said, "Do you not understand the disconnect?" But that's at the state level. There's still a real problem here, even with bicycle advocates in Sacramento saying that, no, we really can't go to our legislators and ask for traffic justice, even for a kid on a skateboard. If you run that kid down, could have happened to anybody. So I'm curious to hear some of your thoughts, and I'm sure our audience cares about this. I see there's already somebody with a question in the back or a comment.
So on the civil side of the law, there is a jury instruction that indicates that the driver of a motor vehicle, because of the instrumentality under their control, it's opportunity to cause greater harm, has a higher degree of care than a bicyclist does that's used in civil cases. that there's a parallel in the law that exists already that could be used to advance the argument such that it's not such a novel and new concept.
Yeah.
But what happens oftentimes, I think, is that on the criminal side, that they defer to civil remedies, which are no good when somebody's dead, and that they don't have the same deterrent effect. But I think that's part of the problem, too, is that they said, we'll defer to a civil court and let people work this out as a financial matter.
Right, and then your insurance company takes care of it.
Yeah, but so that's just dealing with the carnage rather than dealing with prevention. But there is a jury instruction that does differentiate between the risk and harm caused by one user than another, such that there's already a toehold in California law for that purpose.
Good to know.
Yeah, I didn't know that. You think that's in other states?
Probably not. We have a unique way of getting jury instructions done that involves a lot of the plaintiff's bar that has input, which allows us through the judicial commissions to make them work there.
That's good to know.
It is, and that points out. I mean, they are conflating things when they blame the cyclists, the scoff laws, and then use that as a rationale for not implementing, you know, stricter penalties for vulnerable road users.
Yeah,
and it is a disconnect, and they just don't see it. And part of it comes from scoff law. I mean, the scoff law riders don't. You know, I got to tell you. I mean, Portland, with all this coming down, people really do stop at stop signs now. And here, no one does. I couldn't believe it. It's like it used to be. It's like, oh, the good old days. You know, there's no uncommon stop sign, but it's like, I use it like extra training. It's like I come up, I brake pretty hard, and then I accelerate out of it, you know, and the cyclist just goes blowing by me. But
actually, they're rolling stops.
And they can do that. Yeah, that's what it is.
Actually, it's much better now than it used to be. There are more people who are stopping and waiting than there were earlier. As more and more cyclists are on the road, and certainly in areas where there's more and more traffic, I've seen a lot better adherence to the law than there was before. There's still that grade of class two riders who, you know, just blow through everything. But there's a significant number of people now who wait and you know, take it a lot more rationally.
Well, can you talk about the law of stop signs?
You know, fairly well. I mean, I really would research it. If I was going to answer it, like for my column, I'd have to know what state it is, because it's not, you know, that we have a UVC, but sometimes, you know, Unified Vehicle Code, that's a lot of states just adopt, and I can answer generally in that regard. But some states, you got to really read, just like the brake laws on the fixed gears, what constitutes a brake. I mean, you have to parse the language down. It gets really complicated. But do you have a particular question about stop signs?
I just was curious what you might say.
Well,
like, you have, what's a stop?
You know? Yeah, exactly. You have to yield. You have to yield, you know. And are you familiar with the Idaho rules?
That was the question I was coming to ask in a minute. Because it seems like a lot of people are, the bicyclists are sort of saddled with this whole idea of being scoff laws when they're interpreting the laws as it, you know, maybe right or wrong as it applies to them, and maybe a yield at a stop sign is good enough. And that is the law in Idaho. And
just to clarify, if everyone's not clear, and by the way, I want to not only point out Bob's wonderful book, but on the SFBC website, if you go to the bike law page, we've got links to a lot of these things, including you can look at the Idaho Vehicle Code and see just what the rule is. It's quite simple. In Idaho, everything is one less for bikes. A stop sign is a yield sign, and a red light is basically like a stop sign. And so a cyclist pulls up to a red light, looks both ways, pretends it's a stop sign, and continues on. And it seems to go well, and I'd like to get an Idaho attorney here sometime and talk about actual case law and the experience with that. But I want to loop back on this and just to say that, you know, we're talking about vehicular cycling and sort of the facilitated cycling, the principle of you are driving a bicycle, and so as a vehicle, you operate as if you were driving a motor vehicle, and that will get you along. And the other state of mind of saying, well, no, actually, we need bike lanes and bike paths and segregated facilities and things like that. And it's always worth pointing out to people that there really weren't stop signs until there were motor vehicles, and there was not nearly as much of the vehicle code until there were motor vehicles driving around. There had been vehicles before there were cars. They were carts and things like that. But a stop sign is very much a device that was invented to try to keep cars from bouncing off of other cars. It was never needed when there were only just bicycles and mules and people driving sheep. So that's a little pontification, but that's the Idaho law. Research it. We've got links online. And it's all about just being practical with physics.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I was just, you were on a track where you said people in Oregon got all, I wanted to kind of steer the focus back to the two people who just got killed.
Okay.
And, you know, what happened with that? You know, were they, you said the bike community, of course, I'm sure, was really upset. And then did they, you know, what is coming out of that, if anything?
Well, the officer that responded to both scenes, he doesn't have that job anymore. So that was the first thing. And he had been written up in our alternative magazine. He had some incredibly sordid past that was unrelated to that, but with the Nazism and things like that. But he, I don't know, it's unrelated probably to our story, but it just shows you there were a lot of eyes on him. But what they've done recently is... Here's what happened. In the case where I represented the guy, Kyle Edgerton, that got the two tickets that they claimed he was riding the wrong way, they didn't really do a thorough investigation. They said because there was no trauma there. And what they've done is they've changed that. If there are any injuries involving a cyclist, they're going to have a crash investigation now. Not because of me, but because of the cycling crowd. You know, so that's one change, I think. And I do... It's a bigger chunk of our media. You know, you're a big city here. I mean, it's amazing to me how big it is when I'm driving around. And it's a great city. I mean, I always wanted to move here. But I don't know about that anymore, though. I mean, I don't know where I'd ride, but I
do. Oh, dude. We're working on it.
Cycling class.
That was just a joke.
Okay.
So... I'll still move here.
Right.
I just need an extra $2 million to buy an apartment.
After everybody here moves to Portland, you can.
Right, after we move to Portland.
They're a lot cheaper up there, trust me. But so it gets a lot more media attention, and like I was mentioning, the cycling community gets listened to. I don't know what it's like here. You have lots of groups and lots of interests, but it's like we're kind of a boring town. We're not on the coast. We don't have, you know, Marilyn Manson across the street. We don't have... the bridge. We don't have the tourism. So these bike issues are really up in front of everybody's face. And so I think the bike crowd really is feeling empowered. And so we march on City Hall. We have press conferences. We launched the cyclist civil rights movement. And it's underway, in case you hadn't noticed. But it's not really going anywhere. That's my point. And that so really... I don't know if I answered your question. We've gotten a new guy to investigate the crash scenes, and
with those two fatalities, there's no justice that's going to happen.
There'll be civil cases, I'm sure. You know, the families will hire someone, but that, you know, like you're an attorney, I take it, in the back corner, probably. You know, that, like he mentioned. That's not going to do anything for the people that are gone, and it's not necessarily going to change anything, you know. But yeah, there's ongoing civil suits. You got a question? She had before you there.
One thing I'm curious about that we've been looking at here too is what you have in the California Vehicle Code, and the Uniform Vehicle Code is a big gray hole where bicyclists are concerned, and there's codes regulating pedestrian movement, there's codes regulating vehicle movement, but a lot of times there's no space cut out in the code for bicyclists. And one of the places where we're seeing that here in California and in San Francisco in particular is crosswalks that are extensions of multi-use paths, like at the Fell Masonic intersection, where bicyclists don't necessarily have any sort of legal right there because a crosswalk is considered an extension of the sidewalk. In San Francisco, sidewalks are for pedestrians only. So, and I'm also very interested in bicyclists who box intersections because they have no safe way to make a left turn. And I'm curious, in Portland and Oregon or any other states, if you know how either the vehicle code has been adopted or how it could be adopted to permit that sort of safe turning movements and protect bicyclists as they're making those boxing movements.
What's a boxing?
It's when you go across an intersection using the crosswalks, mm-hmm. or riding adjacent to the crosswalks, not in the pedestrian space.
Like a box
we don't
turn.
Want to take pedestrian space away, but if you can't make the left turn comfortably mm-hmm. because you're scared to be out there waiting in the middle of speeding traffic, mm-hmm. A lot of bicyclists will stop and cross the crosswalks.
Well, we are doing something that sort of answers. Well, first of all, you can ride your bike on the sidewalk in Oregon.
Nice.
Unless there's a certain area that's restricted. And so for in case of San Francisco, it'd be like just right down here, and they wouldn't let you, you know, around Market here and Mission, and then when you got 10 blocks, if it was analogous to Portland. But you can ride, but you have, if you get in an accident in the crosswalk, you better not be going more than 3 miles an hour. You have to be going walking speed. And it happens all the time. People are flying down the sidewalk. And in that case, I'm kind of not on the motorist side, but I see their point. You're trying to make a left. You're watching oncoming cars. You're watching pedestrians. And somebody's riding up the sidewalk 20 miles an hour, and you make your turn, and they collide into you. It's really difficult. So it sort of makes sense, but 3 miles an hour is ridiculous. But what we have done is, starting this March, we're going to have 39 or 49 of these boxes painted. You use the word box, but it's sort of related. And they're blue boxes at the head of the intersection. So when you queue up to the... let's say there's a red light and there's 20 cars and you're on your bike. You, these guys all just passed you, and now you caught back up to them. And now, you know, you're going to go to the front and they're going to all pass you again. But you might not have any room. You might want to make a right. There might be a turning lane. So we're painting these blue boxes in. And cyclists can go up, get to the front of the line, and line up in the blue box. And unlike Amsterdam, we don't have our own signal, which would be really cool. You know, just a 5-second head start. Okay, bikers, go for your lives, you know, before the cars. Give you a camp one, give you 5 seconds. In Amsterdam, that's what they do. You know, and I'm going to go back this summer, I think, because it's just such a cool thing to see some of their ideas.
And we do have a couple of very primitive bike boxes already in San Francisco. Those of you, Harrison and 14th, and northbound Scott at Oak.
Well, there's one down in across from Golden Gate Park on 6th Avenue and Fulton.
6th and Fulton.
In 6th Avenue. It changes the light on Fulton.
Oh, yeah, the signal is timed differently, yeah.
No, it has a little bike. Oh, you're talking about...
I'm talking about an advanced... There's a piece of pavement in the street. As Bob says, there's what we call an advanced stop line that holds the cars back. So instead of the cars coming all the way to the intersection, the cars have to stop back 10 or 20 feet. You stake out a space. The bikes filter up, usually on the right, sometimes on the left, but you get up, and then you're more visible. You get that advance, with or without the light. The bikes get to go first. And there's one of these most recently, about 3 years ago, on Scott Street. In San Francisco, they've been implemented in a very cheesy and half-hearted way, where there's only just an advanced stop line and a shared lane chero. And a lot of bicyclists don't even know, oh, that's what that means. Certainly the motorists who drive over and park on the chero don't know what that means. So the colored pavement in Portland is a really important addition to that idea. I'm kind of curious, as a cyclist in Portland, how do you feel about Roger Geller and the bike program, the city side? Is the bike program embraced? Do people feel like they've got a good engagement from the city? Or is there griping about these people aren't moving fast enough? And
you know, I don't know what's going to happen with the bike boxes. I think that's really going to flip out the motorists when you know, because they finally get around the bikers, and then they all filter up and get in front of them again. I think it's going to blow their minds. And they're not going to know what these boxes are, but they're going to put the Department of Transportation people down there. They're going to have signage, and they're all painted blue. You know, so you know there's something different. We have one right now, but no one knows what it is, like you've described. But what they do complain about is, in terms of what Geller's doing, is one of the big things you hear in the media is that we're not paying our fair share. Mm. And that's just bunk. I mean, you know, the roads come out of the general fund. We all pay property tax. We all pay sales tax. A lot of us also own vehicles and pay for that. We don't wear the road out with our cars. We're not tying up the traffic. We're not crushing people under our wheels. So it's just a, it's sort of a, it's a, it's an argument that doesn't really have any honesty to it. It's posed just to be antagonistic.
Two quick part questions. First, is there a lot of animosity between the bicyclist crowd and everybody else in Portland? Because it sounds like all you're touching all over it, but you just haven't said it like that. This sounds like there's a lot of animosity between those two entities, right? Kind of like San Francisco in a way.
I would say that's a fair assessment, yeah.
And the other question is, can a city or a county pass rules that either negate state laws like vehicle code laws or pass more rigid standards? Like, could in California, you are required to have a bicycle light on your bike at night. Could the city of San Francisco come in and say, well, that needs to be visible, that light, you must have it, and it must be visible, say, 1,000 feet, instead of, I think, the standard is like 200 feet or 300 feet. Could they do that, or could they come in and say, you do not, if you're operating a bike in San Francisco at night, have to use a bike light? even though it's state law that says you have to?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I'll defer to my attorney friend back there.
It's an issue of what they call preemption. And generally, the state laws, unless they say they're completely occupying the field, meaning we are, this is the only regulation you can have, most state laws are set as a minimum. And a lot of times, for example, with our sick leave law in San Francisco, we have 9 days that you have to provide people with sick leave. The state has other laws, but then San Francisco can add more to it. So where the state hasn't said, we're the only ones who can legislate here, but we're setting a floor, then the local agencies are certainly free to create something stronger than that. But that's the general rule of it. What they can't do is weaken a state law generally, because that's been a floor established by the state.
Here's a case that we have right in San Francisco. Under California Vehicle Code, it's perfectly legal to park your car in a bike lane. And people will often forward me the clipping from the driver's manual saying, oh my God, this is going to be a typo. This can't be right. What good is a bike lane if you can park in it? And I said, well, that does make you kind of think. But fear not, in San Francisco traffic code says that, no, you may not park or stand in a bike lane, except very small exceptions, off rush hour, you can have active loading. But San Francisco traffic code preempt goes further than, makes stronger than the state rule, and thank goodness for that.
Yeah, and not that it's ever enforced.
Not that it's ever enforced, right? That's a different matter.
Well, I think in the case of the Portland bike box, if I remember correctly, they prohibit free right turn on the red light in those boxes, so you don't have vehicles turning around while cyclists are trying to engage into the bike box. So I think that's one step that they've made to try to accomplish that. Back to the stop signs, I'm from the Pacific Northwest, and I never went through stop signs, you know, there. Yeah. I think what it is, besides being basically Scandinavian, everyone follows the rules more, but I think the bigger thing with it is San Francisco has no diversion program and no clear identification for bicycle, you know, law enforcement, you know, to speak, as there is probably in the Pacific Northwest, but you might know more about that than me, that there is a diversion program in Portland. Do you know?
Yeah, we do. We do have that.
Yeah.
But how's that relevant to the...
Well, what it would do, because a lot of police do not enforce the law in terms of stop signs as much here, because they're stuck with fewer options because there's no diversion, and so there's a tendency just to let it go a lot more than there is from my experience in the Pacific Northwest, which has diversion programs and puts them into routing and classes and stuff like that. To work towards enforcement.
It's like an intermediary.
Yeah, exactly.
Wait, Bert, I got stopped and ticketed for running a stop sign on Haight Street.
I said not as much.
Yeah,
I
they put me into a diversion program.
But
so
you're Kathy Roberts.
The 2020.
Oh.
Where you can work for the bike
coalition. Where you can work for the bike
coalition. Right. You can pay your debt to society by coming in here and stuffing envelopes. But, yeah, the point that Bert is making is we've heard this from cops and others that they're not as interested in pulling a cyclist over for a traffic infraction because the penalty is out of scale, or that cop is going to have to go down and spend a morning at traffic court to deal with this dumb bike. If there was the option to instead write you, in effect, a fix-it ticket to go take bike ed class, the cops might be more forthcoming in writing tickets, and you might be indirectly educating bicyclists more that way. So there's some benefits to that.
You know, we can make all these rules, put bike boxes up, we can do all of this stuff, but if people don't respect us, they don't want us out there, it's still not going to really be great for us. It's not going to be like what it could be. And one of the things I do is, I'm going to also, you know, have this as my message when I give these talks, is talk to your friends and your family, your coworkers about what it's like to bike. And because you need to humanize a cyclist. You know, there's this in-group, out-group kind of thing that goes on. You know, where, you know, I'm a driver, there's one of those guys, and you do something that you would you never swing at somebody's head with an axe or something, but that's what you're doing when you do a close pass. Which leads me to another point, is enforcing these rules. There's a cyclist in Milwaukee, he rides with a camera on, and if people violate the 3-foot passing rule, he goes to the police department, he shows them their license, and says, you know, because he got the camera quality really good, and they are so tired of him, but they've started to actually ticket people because it's easier than it's easier to appease this guy. And can you imagine if we had like 1,000 or 10,000 guys doing that? Mm-hmm. And so that's one thing. The other thing is just talk to people. Like I was staying with some people on the southern Oregon coast, and they heard I was a biker, and this guy goes up, he says, are you one of those guys that wears spandex? You know, I was like, no, I don't wear spandex. And the next day I was riding my bike out, and I have my kit on, you know, I have like bike racing shorts, it's old stuff. But he goes, I thought you didn't wear spandex. And I was like, this is Lycra. So he wanted to see how the bike worked, and I kept talking to him, and he went and he bought a 3-speed, you know, he could just, you know, to ride to town and tool around town. So I won him over. And I was in Mexico, and there's this guy that invented the shark suits. And he goes, you ride road bike? And just the way he said it, I knew something was coming at me. I was like, yeah. And he's a young athlete. Well, he's not too young. He's like my age, but he's athletic. Looked like he might be a biker. But he goes, I had a problem with one of you guys. And he tells me this story about this guy that's holding him up. And when he finally gets by him, he guns it right past him, and he forgets about the cyclist. He goes to a convenience store, and the cyclist spits at him, maybe on him, gets back in his car, catches the guy, and beats him up. And so he got charged with assault. And I talked him through it. I'm like, well, what do you expect? You know, he almost killed his life with a 2,000-pound or 4,000-pound vehicle. What's a little saliva compared to being crushed? You know, we talk, and I said, what would you do? You know, you ride occasionally. What would you know? He's well. I wouldn't put up with that. In group, out group. You know. So I think I won him over. But then there was this attorney from Los Gatos who told me he's actually a lawyer, and he used to play for basketball. He's a huge guy. He never rode a bike, I can tell. And he says, you ride bikes. He said, I had one of these guys screaming and yelling at me at Los Gatos. This conversation's taking place in Mexico. And I said, well, what happened? He said, well, I pulled out, and he came by, and he was yelling at me. And I said, well, what did you do? And he said, well, I don't know. He was going too fast. So I had to go through it with him. You know, he's an attorney. I went through the elements. He's a vehicle, just like you. He had the right of way. You know, I went through the whole thing with him, and I don't know if I won him over or not, but, you know, I think... you know, if I can get one out of two, that's pretty good. And if we all started doing that, it might change the atmosphere. You know, right after somebody gets killed, people sort of... It was really weird in Portland for about 3 or 4 weeks. I'd come to a four-way stop, and they'd be like, you know, you go first, you know? Because you're in the news, you know? It's one of those people that I don't want to kill. But then about 2 weeks later, it was right back to normal.
Yeah.
But it shows that the public can be changed, you know? I mean, I know that's what you guys do. With activism, but what about, you know, the social change? That's what I'm thinking we need to work on.
Well, some of that is walking into a store as if it was a totally normal thing to arrive there on the bike and put your helmet down and spend about $40 on groceries. And that's a very powerful thing that we do here at the Bike Coalition, to get to work and take your helmet off and greet your various subordinates or remind them you're going to be paying their payroll. And being somebody who's a participant in society, now I look over at Bert, the great Johnny Appleseed. You were this morning up at the Breakfast Club, and you swim with the big fish. And a lot of it is to be among other people, because we are other people, and to give little subtle hints that, you know, I got here on a bike today and I didn't have as much trouble parking. But the whole idea of spending money is a very powerful thing. And that's something that our membership now, I can't remember, I've lost track, but, you know, our average household income is a lot higher than people would think. And I would like to remind people about that the Bike Coalition is made up of folks who shop, pay rent, pay mortgage, pay payroll taxes, pay payrolls. And we are among you as an economic force.
It'd be good to have a more direct, like, this is a bike-friendly business.
Yeah.
One thing, and, you know, this concept of the other, people always think that's not me, but maybe on the bike to work day, if you had just labels that people could put on that said daughter.
Yeah. Boss.
Boss. But just simple words. But daughter, mom, boss.
Yeah.
Husband, wife, I want to get home. And if it just said that much, then I think that could be my wife, that could be my daughter, that could be my brother.
Yeah.
But that kind of simple messaging takes this concept of the other, which is inherent with the car and the bike. I'm a car, you're other than me, but no, it could be my wife or my child. But that simple messaging also may work for you.
Yeah,
exactly.
I was wondering if you could compare, either in Portland or here in San Francisco, what the comparison is between a scooter and a motorcyclist. For example, those incidents that you referred to on turning right. If a motorcycle, which they always do...
We don't have that. You mean where the motorcycles can ride outside of the lanes, lane split? We don't have that law.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But I mean...
well, motorcycles do it here, our scooters do it here all the time. That would pull up to the, you know.
Oh, the boxes, you mean?
To the right side of a vehicle and try to get a head start.
So you're asking if that would be, I don't follow your question.
Well, if a car or a truck is turning right,
yeah,
and takes down a motorcycle or a scooter.
Exactly. I mean, so it's sort of a rhetorical question. You're saying
would they have more, you know, would they be considered more of a legitimate vehicle on the roads versus a bicycle?
I'm not sure. I'm not really sure. So you,
here's a local attorney. Sir. <Yeah. clears
throat> Well, I'm answering this one with motorcycles.
Ah.
I ride bicycles and I ride motorcycles. Very often, you know, I'll pull up along the side of a line of cars to get up to the head of an intersection. But if I'm in a right-hand lane or a lane from where people are going to be making right-hand turns, I usually only go all the way up to the front if I can see that I've got enough space so that I can stick out 3 or 4 feet in front of that car, and I always look back and make eye contact with the driver. Just confirm that they know that I'm there. So they're not going to do the right turn.
I can sort of answer. I just, believe it or not, or bet, I was reading the vehicle code about this, and there's a vehicle code that describes that you're required as a vehicle. I think it's like motorcycles, bicycles, and cars to, as much as practical, stay fully in the lane unless it's safe to leave the lane. So that's the loophole that you can split at a stop sign, is that it's safe to do that. But otherwise, you have to be fully in the lane. It's a sharing code.
It's actually an oddity of sorts, because the vehicle code has 2 points in it that contradict each other. There's a vehicle code section that says that bicyclists are supposed to ride as close to his hand as possible to the right-hand side. Vehicle code section 21202.
Second 20.
Yeah. And, well, that's turning and moving out of the lane, but what it does say is that you're supposed to, bicyclists, they want as close to the right-hand side of the road as possible, but then they have another section that says they have the same rights as car drivers, which is what you're talking about, bikes as vehicles. So it contradicts with each other. But then it tells car drivers, if you're going to make a right-hand turn, you have to do it as close as practical to the right-hand side of the roadway, meaning you have to pull over the curb. And in the vehicle code handbook, it says you need to do that so bicyclists don't get between you and the curb. So that's the way that they put it in the vehicle code handbook for a car driver. So there are these overlappings, like the woman was saying here, about these gray areas and contradictions between the vehicle code itself.
Yeah, it's funny. Many people have pointed out that even though bicycles in California and elsewhere are governed by the vehicle code, you can point to places where bicycles are not vehicles. They are a device or they're a gizmo, but there is, depending on how you parse it, there are ways that, you know, a bicycle is not a vehicle. Now, yeah. I don't believe that, because if I'm governed by the vehicle code, then, oh, darn it, I'm operating a vehicle.
Why is that? It seems like in 21202, it explicitly says that bicycles are not vehicles, but that they have to obey all the rules of the vehicles that cars obey, yeah, and have all the responsibilities and rights of bicycles. But yet they're not vehicles. And is there a legal? Why is that?
I don't know. In California, a bicycle is not a vehicle technically.
Right there as well. And again, we could. This is one to come back to later.
Rights and responsibilities of a vehicle.
Right. Yeah. It's angels on the head of a pin. Because you are indeed governed by the vehicle code, and there's this equivalency. So I tell people,
with insurance. See, vehicles have to have insurance. Bikes don't have to have insurance. But you're, as a bicyclist, you have to follow the rules of the vehicle code. So that's part of where the oddity falls in, as to whether or not you have to be insured. Where all motor vehicles have to be insured.
Right. I see. Well, you know what, Bob? You've been standing up there for a long time. I want to give you an out, but we were talking on the phone, and you mentioned that you were up to something with Lance, and that would be Lance Armstrong. I want to tell everybody, if you haven't picked up the book, buy a copy. His introduction is a great story about rogue assault and justice and Lance getting even. It's a very gratifying story. And we've been reading in the last couple of days stories coming out of Austin about Lance opening up a shop and becoming active in the advocacy world down in Texas.
Yeah.
Tell us what's up. What are you doing with Lance?
It is cool that he's getting into another area of cycling besides
you know, bike racing. He's opening up a shop, and it's going to be, it's going to have showers, and it's going to have coffee, and a coffee shop, and it's going to be all commuters' bikes. Because this is a big thing. We had the Portland handmade bike show a couple weeks ago, and it was, they had enormous crowds. They had bikes piled up to get in there, and they were cutting them off because they were on handrails and things. Mm-hmm. But when you went in the place, it was sold out. You couldn't get in. You had to wait. And all the showstoppers were city bikes, mm-hmm. just beautiful city bikes. And one of them, the guy spent 6 months making it. It was $15,000, and I think Lance mm-hmm. bought it and brought it home. But he's going to do this kind of shop, and I think it's a trend that we're going to see. You know, it's like, and that's a great time from my way of looking, because I don't think that's going anywhere. It's not a fad. I mean, once you start riding your bike, I have like what I sort of steal the term, but like the bike lifestyle. Because I bought one of these extra cycles. I don't know if anybody knows
yeah.
that. And I can carry 3 full bags on either side of groceries, and my daughter can sit on the back and have handlebars. So I can go grocery store shopping, and I have a city bike, and I have a fixed gear bike, and my battery is dead right now. I'm sitting on the street, Portland. I have no juice in my Jeep because I haven't started it long enough.
That's all we ask. Kill your battery.
I got to replace it because, you know, I mean, sometimes I got to go on the highway to go somewhere to a court or something, but I hate driving, and I'm one of these people that gets so mad the way people drive, and my blood pressure goes up, and my day goes down. And when I ride my bike, it's never that way. I'm breathing in, I'm breathing out, I'm getting my head clear, and I'm getting there, and I just love it. And I try to talk people into doing it, especially bike racers, you know. Because a lot of bike racers, they're into it for a different reason. But if you can do that, it's not practical everywhere in the United States.
No.
But it is here.
It is here, and it is in Portland. And I just can't wait to see Lance hauling groceries in his bucket. That's
he said he's afraid of the cars in Austin.
Yeah, he's afraid of the cars, but he's gonna make it better. That's great. Well, Bob, thank you so much. If you're going to stick around a little bit, maybe people have a couple more questions, but I hate to see you just standing there getting peppered.
You guys know more than I do in most cases.
Yeah, no, it's great to have you.
When you mentioned city bikes, I wonder what you think of a good city bike. I was in Barcelona about a year ago, and there were bikes everywhere, and they look different from the bikes I looked at here to buy. They're designed differently, like more comfortable, more upright. I just wondered what you thought.
Yeah, probably there are people here that have better views on that than I. I'm sort of new to it, but from my way of looking at it, you hit it. But, you know, convenient, easy to shift, no parts to break, nothing to wear out, nothing to oil, no grease on your pants leg, a way to carry things. You know, I ran into Sky Yeager. I don't know if anybody here knows her. She designed all the Bianchi cool bikes, and she works for Suovo now. And I was up at the start in just for the Sausalito thanks. And she showed me her new city bike. It's got an internal hub. You just click to shift. It's got a basket already built on it. You can put the panniers on it. It's just really clean, you know, nothing but pedals and a seat. Like they have, you know, and, you know, they're importing a lot of the bikes from Amsterdam now. But I think the Americans will be like, oh, we can do better. You know, we can make something better here. So I don't have a recommendation, but I use that extra cycle, and I use a fixed gear, which I can ride backwards.
Sweet. Can you stand on the seat and do tricks and stuff?
No. I saw the woman doing handstands on the handlebars on YouTube. Unbelievable. Doing circles, standing herself up. But I am going to YouTube myself riding backwards, see what that does for my business.
That'll boost it. Yeah.
Sure.
I'm curious, just from thinking about this so much, and this is a very, very broad question, and answer it on whatever scale you want, but I'm curious about what pieces of legislation you feel that national, state, and local bicycle advocacy groups should be pushing forward to really start fighting back at what you're talking about with bicycle rights getting chipped further and further away. What are important pieces of code that you see that need to be changed, or other pieces of the legal process?
You know, I probably defer that to someone else, but the one that's right on the top of my list is the right to ride. I mean, my first chapter, I did all the constitutional analysis about the right to travel, that the government cannot abridge it. Mm. You know, you have when you get your driver's license, that's a license. You know, you it's not a right. You know, they give it to you, you have to pass, they can take it away. But riding a bike is different. You don't need a license for it. That's like, it's locomotion. It's moving yourself from place to place. You know, we have a right and a freedom for interstate travel, and we have an argument. There's an argument you have to have intrastate right to travel and be free to travel. And a bicycle is a great way to do it. And I talk about how when people protest in the downtown areas of cities, like in New York at the Republican National Congress, what they did to cyclists, and I highlighted in my book, and I reference a movie, and Still We Ride.
Oh,
I don't
yeah.
know if anybody here is familiar with that.
Oh, yeah.
That's going to be – it's not the last time we're going to see that, because there's a view of cyclists as being – rabble-rousers is the way, because if you have a big protest downtown, the city can close it down, you can't get there, but bikes can come filtering in. And so a lot of times in Portland when we have protests, they come on bike. And so, and it's the same in New York. And what they did is they had that critical mass ride for years with no problems. The police would give them escorts, but when the Republican National Congress was there, it was like they waited and then they blew the whistle. They were kicking people off of their bikes. I saw the film. They're dragging them. A lot of people didn't get their bikes back. They sat in these little... these quickly built little pens for 3 days in 90-degree heat, and it's not that's a larger civil rights issue, but because it touches the cycling, I highlighted it, and so for me that's the main one. But I know that's not technically what you were asking. In terms of the vulnerable user is a good one. What we don't have in Oregon is vehicular homicide. So they can give you a ticket for killing someone, or they can try to get you for gross negligence, which would be, the standard. It's very difficult to prove. No jury would probably convict it. The DAs won't bring those cases. So there's nothing in between. So we've got to push to have negligent homicide added to our laws. And I think that's something that all the states should have for cyclists in mind.
Do we have that in California, do you know?
I think they do. Yeah, I think they do. And our standard, you have to be the person did something so egregious, almost to the point of intentional, or they should have been apprised that what they were doing was going to cause a bad
injury. People have gotten away with that here. If you look at the case of Chris Robertson a few years ago, back in 1999.
Yeah, I think that's, part of, if I can jump in on an answer to that, that I think attorneys might want other tools to grab, and certainly enforcement officers might want other laws, but it's more of a case of the enforcement and the pursuit of prosecution that is lacking more than the law to grab and work with.
It took 6 weeks to get charges brought against him.
We have Chris Robertson's story and many others like that where there were adequate laws. Sir?
One of the legislative things that I would think you might want to look at in terms of as bicycling becomes more important and bike paths are hopefully made more available, the government has exempted itself in this state from liability if you get hurt on a dangerous bike path. If you're riding your bike on the street and the road is bad and you get hurt, you have recourse against the government, which encourages them to make the road safe. If you're on a designated Class 1 bike path, there's an immunity where the government can have the shittiest bike path on the planet, and you cannot seek recovery if you're catastrophically injured, which gives them very little impetus to make bike paths with safety in mind.
There was an appeal pending. Did that settle?
Well, the current status of the law is that Class 1 designated bike path gives immunity to a governmental agency.
Yeah, and there was a case, and it's 6 months ago, I remember being approached to come up with some financial support for the pursuit of that. I think it was an appeal, and I lost track of that.
It hasn't been changed because we were dealing with the issue the other day as it relates to the bike path on 580.
Yeah.
Where two young men were very badly injured by a car that left the roadway. And the state tried to claim that was a Class 1 bike path, and we were able to show it wasn't.
Yeah.
But they were trying to say that a side of the highway was a bike path, ergo they didn't need to make it safe.
Right.
And the judge didn't buy it. But that's a very significant issue. As more movement is put to give bike paths, or make bike paths, they need to be also made safe, or else there's a track that's created.
Well, and there's a case of sort of a double standard to say there's right-of-way for real people, and then there's this right-of-way for second-class citizens, and that right-of-way doesn't enjoy the same protections that the real people's right-of-way does.
Well put.
Yeah.
Well, everyone wants to go home and
think about
so
it.
So do I.
Hey, listen, we've got copies of Bob's book. I'd be happy to sell you one for $20 if you don't have one. And you're going to want one or two or three. So come find me and we'll set you up with a copy of this very excellent book. And thank you very much, Bob, for coming down and spending some time with us.
Thank you.
All right. Well, that's another Bikescape. Please tune in next episode, should be real soon, hopefully, a one-on-one interview with Bob himself and about the recent tragedy down peninsula, down south of San Francisco near Cupertino. I appreciate all kinds of advice, brickbats, whatever, sent off to in my direction. You can reach me at Bikescape at sbcglobal.net. You can find the blog at bikescape.blogspot.com, and you can leave comments there. You can look at old shows and a whole veritable goldmine of Bikescape trivia. So anyway, keep your head down. Keep that rubber side down as well, and take the lane. And by the way, next week we will talk about what take the lane means in detail. So thank you and goodbye.